to finish our discussion of evolution, and then we'll start talking about anatomy. Question.
The function of the notochord.
You know, that's a good question. Why did it evolve in the first place? It gives the body some rigidity, but I'd just be making it up. What is an animal? What would it be like if it didn't have the notochord? It would be a worm, you know. And it looks like a worm when it first evolves, but it's a chordate. It's got a notochord. We can say a lot more than that about it. Its roles, it plays clear roles in the evolution of the brain. There are inductive influences from the notochord that affect the overlying nervous system. And we'll talk about that when we talk about development. Okay, let's just go back a little bit. We're talking about evolution of the brain. Remember, we looked at the simplest possible neural tube in a chordate in Amphioxus, and we talked about the evolution of forward locomotion that led to the need for head receptors. As head receptors evolved, they led to an enlargement of the anterior end, so we call that the brain. There were expansions of structures in the brain that received inputs from the head receptors. Give me an example of inputs that come in through a cranial nerve rather than a spinal nerve. Vision, yes, would be one. What's the one that comes in most anterior, way up at the rostral end? Olfactory, you see it here. And that's where we'll start today. The forebrain expanded initially. We're talking about forebrain, not the whole brain, because of the influence of olfaction and the importance of olfaction for approach and avoidance functions, feeding, mating, behavior, predator avoidance, and so forth. The links to the locomotor system were not made by direct connections. Initially, they were made through links through the midbrain. We know, we're guessing that from studies of primitive animals, primitive vertebrates. So that's what we're showing here. I added those words at the top. So the expansions continued then with the development of structures in between sensory and motor structures for various functions. Maintaining stabilities, stability in space, approach and avoidance functions, and that led to the evolution of these specialized structures, particularly in the midbrain. Showing here a fish with an expanded midbrain as well as cerebellum. Important for, the midbrain was connected to the cerebellum for coordinating movements. And the midbrain expanded with the evolution of distance receptors other than olfaction. Now, olfaction could be called a distance receptor, but the real distance receptors are vision and audition, which has many advantages for speed, sensory acuity, early warning, and for anticipating things that are about to happen. So when that evolved on the motor side, you have to be able to turn the receptors, which means orienting movements. And the midbrain became particularly important for that. And I'm showing here in the picture fibers coming from the eye coming into the midbrain. It's interesting, the eye did not evolve initially from the midbrain. It originated as an outpouching of the tweenbrain and probably played even more, had more primitive functions initially, coordinating activity with the day-night cycle, just detecting light. But once the connection to the midbrain was formed, then it took on the role that required an expansion,
the sensory analyzers of the midbrain tectum. And the midbrain then became the major, we could call it a sentinel, detecting predators. It also played an important role in orienting and feeding. Okay, then finally, my fifth stage here, expansion of the forebrain again, but now, not because of olfaction anymore, but because non-olfactory systems invaded the endbrain. And they did so not just, they initially invaded the corpus striatum, a very important structure in plasticity of habit formation and so forth, important in both feeding and approach and avoidance functions, in feeding and predator avoidance, but in learning. But then something very interesting happened. The corpus striatum was not a cortical structure, was not a layered structure at the surface of the brain, like the cortex of the olfactory system was. But when that cortex began to be invaded by these other sensory systems, vision and audition and somatic sensation, it led to a great expansion of the forebrain, the endbrain part of the forebrain, the very rostral end of the brain. And I'm showing here a projection from the tectum carrying visual and auditory information into the forebrain through the tween brain. I show a connection there in the tween brain, then a connection into the end brain. Now that kind of connection initially went into the corpus striatum, okay? And I mention here that what was happening on the motor side, but that didn't happen so much until the end brain expanded. I mentioned this before, elaboration of other things that were going on, elaboration of complex programs for goal-directed activities, the so-called fixed action patterns. If I put a red star here, it probably means I've changed the slide a little bit since you have your printout. I probably added here this phrase, the great mammalian elaborations, just to stress that the additions to the brain that happen for reward-driven learning and habit formation in the corpus striatum, which was closely linked to neocortex, was something that happened in mammals, especially because of the evolution of neocortex. Okay. Oh yes, there's certainly reward functions in non-mammalian animals also, but it was the expansion of the neocortex which elaborated the possibilities of input to those structures that led to the biggest expansion. That's a good question. He asked me if non-mammals go for things like cocaine, which is a, these kinds of addictions are, you could say they're acquired pathologies of the reward system, the motivational system. That's a good question. I'm not sure, but I would guess they probably do. Okay, so what systems evolved to modulate other brain systems in for motivational control, visceral and social needs? These are the structures that you should think of there. I put them in blue here. These are the functions we're talking about, control of motivation, elaboration of hierarchies of goals, and communication of needs to other members of the species. And the main structures that evolved here were the hypothalamus, which were connected to the lower structures that did that. And then the structures in the end brain that were most closely connected to the hypothalamus. And we call those structures the limbic system of the forebrain. And then along with that, of the further elaboration of the end brain, and this happened really only with neocortex, systems for anticipating, in predicting things on the sensory side, images that could simulate objects and events. On the motor side, planning of actions. These were non-reflex functions that I talked about at the end of the introductory lectures. And here, it was the neocortex that played the primary role. In fact, at these higher functions, cognitive functions, the structures that expanded the most in the neocortex were the so-called association areas. Those are the areas that, in us, occupy the largest part of our neocortex. Along with that, all parts of the neocortex are connected to the corpus striatum. Okay. And the parts that get those connections from the neocortex have expanded also. So it's not just one thing that expands. Many things expand in parallel. And before that, the end brain of the animals leading to mammals was dominated by olfaction, the paleocortex, and more ancient parts, the corpus striatum. And you can see that by looking at the brains of these various species. And I'm showing here this expansion of the inbrain. I put here a picture based on brains of fish, showing the smaller inbrain, little tween brain, and then a larger brain stem, midbrain and hindbrain, larger than the inbrain. But then, in mammals, you have the evolution of neocortex. That's the structure that's pretty much unique with mammals, although higher birds also have structures like neocortex, but it doesn't have the same structure as the neocortex of mammals. Okay, but they do have, they have structures we don't have that are similarly connected. Okay. The relative size of structures I'm showing here would be, well, in proportion about the brain of a rodent. Okay. So this is just in the earlier expansion of the cortex, and then I'm showing here along with it expanded the cerebellum. Okay. Parts, the more lateral parts of the cerebellum. Okay. And also, I'm not showing here at all the neostriatum. Okay, now before we go to a more systematic coverage of neuroanatomy, let's just talk a little bit about what's happening to the brain in evolution if we just look at the weight. First of all, we don't have the heaviest brains. The heaviest brains are in animals that are larger than us, especially much larger, like whales, elephants. If you look at here, brain weight is on the ordinate here. See, we here have at the top the blue whale, also the elephant, the porpoise, and here's modern humans. Okay, but it's plotted here on a against body weight. Okay, and if you look at that graph, and you'll see that humans are the furthest from this line here in proportion to body weight. The brain is larger in humans. Okay, there are actually a few exceptions. Porpoises are probably very close to us, partly because they don't have limbs, so their spinal cords don't have the enlargements with the extra neurons supporting the limbs. Okay, so that distorts that picture a little bit. And there are some little rodent-like animals that have a pretty high brain to body weight ratio, but we don't talk much about them. Here, if you look at the various animal groups on this, that kind of graph, you'll see that the mammals are different, although there's overlap with birds and other animals, and the more primitive vertebrates are the furthest to the lower right here. Now we know some of the factors that affect brain size. Not just intelligence, by a long shot. Okay, and we'll say a little bit more about that in a minute here. First of all, these terms, the notochord, you see it spelled in both these ways, with the H or without the H, and I'll accept either one, but the first one is actually the supposedly the proper one. But don't spell spinal cord with the H, okay? Only it is a cord, okay? C-O-R-D. Let's say a little bit about the relationship of development or ontogeny, the development of the individual. Comparing that to difference in species, phylogeny. We want to know whether development can tell us anything about evolution. There's a popular phrase that ontogeny recapitulates phylogeny. What does that mean? Okay. What it means is that the earlier the stage of embryonic development, the greater the resemblance of different species. Okay. So if you take, say, the brain of a pig or the brain of a monkey compared to the brain of humans, at very early stages of development, they all look the same. Okay? But as you get later, you get more and more divergence. Okay? Let's look at the pictures from Romanus, 1901. Okay? Here he's showing at a very early stage, fish, salamander, a tortoise, a chick, a hog, a calf, a rabbit, and a human. We see very similar appearances in all these different vertebrates in early stages. But now, in the middle stages, a little later, you see that already the fish and the salamander are looking very different. Okay. But the reptile here, the bird, and all the mammals still look pretty similar. There are some small differences beginning to appear. And then when we get much later in development, and we're still here pretty early in gestation for humans, we see more differences occurring. Now, if we had a monkey in there or an ape, we would say that at this stage, the human still looks pretty much the same as these primates. Okay. It seems that they diverge later in development if they diverge later in evolution. That's the correlation that seems to hold. Okay. This just to remind you that my outline of high priority behavioral demands based mainly on studies of evolution and comparative studies of behavior. And I've correlated that with changes in anatomy. And I emphasize that it's speculative here, but it is based on a lot of information. And I support it with illustrations from comparative anatomy. Well, these are the various stages. We've already reviewed that today, so I won't go over this now. I just want to remind you that we have these data that I showed you before that show the importance of relative size or specialized functions. Remember the expansions of the hindbrain here with specialized taste functions in these fish. But I just want to mention some other specializations so you won't assume that it's only these fish that give us this. Some fish have electroreception. We don't have that, but many fish have this. They can detect disturbances in the electric field that they generate around their body with the electric organs. In the mormyrid fish, this has led to an enormous expansion of the cerebellum. So if you open the skull, all you see is cerebellum. It covers everything. It's like when you open a human skull, all you see is the neocortex. Okay. We still don't fully understand exactly what the cerebellum is doing in those animals or even in us, although we have some ideas about it. Let's look at another specialization. What is a pit viper? It's a snake that has a specialized pit organ, okay, on its head, okay. It has infrared detectors in those pit organs. So in total darkness, a snake can detect your presence or the presence of anything warm, okay, because it can detect infrared radiation, okay. And we can do that too, but only if we invent a machine to do it. Okay. Bats and porpoises have echolocation, so that's another specialized sense that's led to an expansion in their auditory system and midbrain, controlling orientation movements. They also have expanded. There are some studies of bat and the neocortex, expanded auditory regions in the neocortex as well. Primates. What's most characteristic of the primates? Vision. High visual acuity. Learned object recognition. That's led to expansion of visual cortical areas. If you look at the brain of a rhesus monkey, I mean, it looks like more than half of the brain is occupied by areas related to vision. In rodents, the comparable thing would be representation of the whiskers, their face, the vibrissae, okay? They have specialized somatosensory systems, and they're frequently studied in neuroscience because of this. So there are other examples. I'll mention a few other behavioral specializations. These are all correlated with elaborations in the brain. The hand. We mentioned vision in the primates, but also they have specialized hands, okay? But so do raccoons, okay? And humans, of course, especially, which requires a lot of tactile acuity and fine motor control, both. And these lead to expansions, or correlated with expansions in the somatic sensory motor cortex and in the cerebellar hemispheres, connected with those areas of the hemispheres. Other animals have, this monkey also has a specialized tail, a prehensile tail, and he's got something we don't have at all, expanded tail representations and sensory and motor cortex, okay, for both the motor control of that tail and the sensory detection with the tail, the specialized glabrous skin, like the skin of our fingers and palm that he has on his tail. Yes? Spider monkeys? You never seen a movie of spider monkey and the way they use their tail? They use their tail like we use our hands. When they go through the trees, they're using their hands too. They're using the tail and the hands. Okay. And they can, when they touch things with the tail, they can be, it's like we touching with our hands. They have good acuity. And I just want to point out here that in humans, language is a specialization, and that's led to expansions also, or it's correlated with expansions of the polymodal association cortex, the parietal, temporal, and frontal lobes. It's also led to hemispheric specialization. There may be other reasons, though, that lead to hemispheric specialization. Okay. And finally, I don't know if you'll hear about this in other classes, but the elaborate social organization and planning and problem solving that you have in social animals, social mammals, okay, that has a representation in the brain too, especially prefrontal neocortical areas in the primates, okay, is huge in us, okay, and a lot of it has to do with planning and problem solving, anticipating what we're going to do. Okay. Because females are so good at that, I would probably say the female brain expanded first and the male had to catch up. Okay, sorry. But there are more women in this class. I've got to say a few things I've had. It's probably true. Okay, there is actually a theory of brain evolution that takes that view. Okay, let's now start talking about going back to brain connections. Okay, let's talk about basic subdivisions of the brain, basic types of neurons. We introduced that before. Okay, basic channels of conduction of sensory information through and into the brain. And then I'll give you an overview of the cephalic structures. And finally, we'll talk about the specialized connections that evolve with the elaboration of neocortex in the mammals. I'm going to use the shmoo brain for this. So I'll have to tell you what a shmoo is, and then we'll identify the basic structures and learn some definitions. Here's a shmoo here in the corner. I got this. He's very cute little animal. He evolved in the brain of Al Capp, who was a cartoonist in Chicago. And this describes... people used to read this every time he published a little cartoon series in the Chicago newspapers. And this is just to remind you a little bit about Shmoo, because he loves all Course 9 students instinctively and without fail, no matter what. Well, you can read these. You're all so serious. Gosh, Shmoo is... Well, the schmooze is sort of serious, too, but he also makes you laugh. Okay. So what is it? It's a pedagogical device, of course. It was invented by Nauta, the great neuroanatomist who finished his career here at MIT. He invented it to illustrate some basic principles of the anatomical organization of the brain of animals, suggested to be ancestral to mammals. The first schmoo could represent a generalized amphibian brain. He usually described it that way. It was based on the work of C. Judson Herrick, okay, an American comparative anatomist, and then more recent anatomical studies as well, studies of connections that Herrick did not know so well because he didn't use experimental studies to study connections the way Nauta and his students did. Now, why do we study primitive? Why do I introduce the brain by talking about primitive brains? Why don't I just save time and go right to the human brain, like they do in medical school? Okay. Well, you'll find that you'll appreciate more and more why I do that as we go on. But it's also relevant because not only helps you learn, but we still have all those parts. Because when the brain evolved, we don't just throw things out and replace it with something new. We just add to what we had before. Okay? Very little is discarded. I mean, there are some things that that might get smaller. But basically, we keep everything. So you still have that ancestral brain, the core of your human brain. Okay? That little newt you see crawling in the slime of the swamp, or you might find in your basement, has connections in his brain that you also have in yours. And when we get very angry, we probably use those a lot more. Okay, let's first give you the outline here. This is my outline of Shmoo 1. And here are the subdivisions. I want you to know all of these. They're very basic. You know some of them already. It shows the spinal cord here at the caudal end. Here you see at the rostral end, the olfactory bulb. Here's the midbrain. The hindbrain and the midbrain. In the hindbrain, I've shown the cerebellum. in the midbrain, the little bumps there represent the tectum of the midbrain. The more anterior one is often called the optic tectum. That's where those visual connections go. And this is all forebrain. And I've got it divided into different parts here. The lower part here is the more caudal part is the tween brain, and I've got the two major divisions here, thalamus and hypothalamus. There are a couple other divisions too. Okay. But we know most about the two largest parts, the thalamus and the hypothalamus. And then the end brain, corpus striatum, subcortical structure, other subcortical parts of the connected with that we call limbic because they're connected by hypothalamus. They're at sort of at the fringes of the hemispheres. And then cortical structures related to olfaction and what we call limbic cortex. Some of that cortex that is not just olfactory, but it's connected to hypothalamus. There's no neocortex in Shmoo 1, okay? Now, in the most primitive amphibians that this is based on, there is very little anything that looks like neocortex. There's a little bit of cortex they call general cortex that's probably the predecessor of it. And here, I've shown some of the basic connections. Looks like a mishmash to you at the moment, but it won't as we proceed. Now here I'm showing you what the actual neural tube looks like, although I've exaggerated the thickness of the spinal cord and brainstem a bit here. Remember, it's a tube. It's a tube that then expands more in some regions than others. And on the right here, I've shown the cross-sections of these various levels. There's a cross-section through the embryonic spinal cord and the embryonic hindbrain, the embryonic midbrain. Okay. And then you see the tween brain and end brain here. The tween brain has this heart shape in its cross-section, and then the end brain with a corpus striatum below the ventricle and the cortex above. Okay? And I'm showing here, again, the basic subdivisions, which I would like you to learn there, and I've given you both the English, okay, and the Greek names. So we'll keep repeating these. I'll mention this. I don't expect you to like learn it instantly. And I will repeat this a number of times to try to get you to relax a little bit. Neuroanatomy takes a little time to acquire. You have to get it repeatedly. And so I will go over things repeatedly in the class. You'll also do some readings. Don't get too frustrated with yourself when you have trouble remembering it, because it's like you can connect it with, it takes on more meaning to you when you know a little bit more about connections and about function, and it'll grow on you. Okay, then we'll look at where these things are in the brain. Let's talk a little bit about the primary sensory neurons in different animals. This is a picture from Ramon y Cajal showing primary sensory neurons that carry input from the body surface, okay, in various species here. Here he has a sensory cell in the earthworm that goes to a sensory ganglion in the earthworm. And notice that the primary sensory neuron is in the surface epithelium of the body surface. Okay? This is the epithelium. A derivative of the ectoderm, the surface layer of the embryo. The entire nervous system, in fact, is a derivative of the ectoderm. Here he shows a sensory cell in the mollusk, which is similar, but the cell body now has moved deep to the surface, but it's still connected with the surface. Okay, so now it's become a bipolar neuron with the input side at the surface and then the output side here in the sensory, in the ganglion or central nervous system. Okay. And then he gets to vertebrates here, And he's showing a sensory cell in a lower fish here, which is still a bipolar neuron, receiving inputs from the surface, carrying it into the central nervous system, the neural tube now, because now we're invertebrates. We're all chordates, okay? And then finally, in amphibians, reptiles, birds, and mammals, the sensory cells innervating the body surface have this, we call it a pseudo-unipolar shape, okay, with the cell body off to the side, dendritic part of the cell is out here, and then the axon goes into the central nervous system this way. So these, the outlines here show what we would call a peripheral or ganglion, collections of those kinds of cells. Okay, so now let's go back to the Schmoo brain. Now, where are the primary sensory neurons? I've shown just three of them here. Here is an example, only one, showing a cell that would be in the dorsal root ganglia, in one of the dorsal root ganglia, okay, which are next to the spinal cord. So it's pseudo-unipolar in shape. It has its dendritic endings out here in the skin. The axon starts there, goes into the central nervous system where it connects with the secondary sensory neurons. Okay. Here's another one. This would be in the auditory or vestibular system, and note that it has a bipolar shape. There are many fewer of these, okay, but in the auditory system we have bipolar neurons. The sensory end or dendritic end out in the cochlea or in the vestibular canals, okay. And then the action potential has to go by the cell body, it sort of jumps over it, and the axon then continues into the central nervous system where you have the cochlear nuclei and the vestibular nuclei, the secondary sensory cells of those systems. And finally here I show another primary sensory neuron, the olfactory, an olfactory neuron, an example of one olfactory neuron. And note, it's just like all the sensory cells in the worm. Okay, the cell body is in the at the surface, in the epithelial layer. Okay, that's in the mucosa, the olfactory mucosa lining our nasal passages. Then it has a little dendritic part here in a mucus over these cells, responds to molecules dissolved in that substance. Those molecules that trigger action potentials, the action potential goes through the primary olfactory neuron's axon into the brain. Part of the brain here we call the olfactory bulb, where it contacts secondary sensory cells of the olfactory system. Okay, so three examples. Primary sensory neurons. The secondary sensory neurons are the ones that get input to it. Everything else is an interneuron, and of course we want to understand how are those interneurons connected, what kind of systems do they form. The only exception that we don't call interneuron here is the motor neuron, and I'm showing it here in the little black triangles that you see in the ventral part of the brain, in the spinal cord, but also in the hindbrain and in the midbrain, okay, where there are collections of these motor neurons. Motor neurons are defined as the neurons with an axon that goes out of the central nervous system, okay, and we have two kinds of motor neurons there, and I've shown the two kinds here. One type, the axon goes to muscle cells, to striated muscle cells. I've shown, depicted the striations there to indicate it's a particular kind of muscle cell. It's not a smooth muscle. The other kind of motor neuron connects with a ganglion. So we call it a preganglionic motor neuron of the autonomic nervous system. The autonomic nervous system innervates smooth muscles and glands. Okay? So there the connection is different. It goes through a relay in a peripheral ganglion of the autonomic nervous system. And then those cells in those ganglia connect to smooth muscle and gland tissue. Okay? So two kinds of motor neurons. Okay, so we've defined now the subdivisions, the primary sensory neurons, secondary sensory neurons, interneurons of the great intermediate net, two kinds of motor neurons, cranial nerves, 1 and 8. Well, cranial nerve 1, you generally, the cranial nerves are the nerves coming into the head, in the head that come into the brain above the spinal cord, and they're numbered from rostral to caudal. Okay, there's quite a few of them, well over 20 in fact, but there's only 12 major ones in humans, and so we usually think of just 12 cranial nerves. The first one, the rostral one, is the olfactory. The 8th one is the auditory and vestibular. Okay, and those are the only ones I'm showing here, which is why I put it here to be identified in the Schmoo brain here. Okay, so now, what happens to the input when it comes in? And here we're going to focus on spinal cord initially, but the other sensory systems have similar channels of conduction. In every case, we can talk about a local reflex channel, cerebellar channel, and lemniscal channels, plural. Okay. And we're going to learn all these terms. We'll first talk about segmental reflexes, okay? And we'll define dermatome and myotome. Okay. Here would be we could call it also a local reflex channel. We can follow input through a primary sensory neuron in the Schmoo brain here, contacts secondary sensory cells, and some of those have fairly short connections through interneurons reaching motor neurons. Now, if that all happens within one segment of the spinal cord, a segment being defined as the area connected with one spinal nerve, one dorsal root, okay. So there's about 32 segments in the cord. And if that then goes from sensory to motor within one segment, contacts the motor neuron, we would call it a segmental reflex, okay, or local reflex. If it comes in at one segment here, but the output through interneurons connects with other segments in the cord, then we would call it an intersegmental reflex. But if it involves these long axons going up into the brain, the lemniscal channels, before it comes back, if we're going to call it still a reflex, we would call it a suprasegmental reflex, okay? Because it involves conduction above the segments of the spinal cord. Okay, now, if we're dealing with one dorsal root here, which is a collection of axons, of course, coming through one spinal nerve, those axons originate out on the body surface from just a limited part of the skin, and we call the skin innervated by one spinal nerve. We call it a dermatome, and this is a dermatomal map, okay, showing usually there's no first cervical segment, the dorsal root. We start with C2 to C8, and then the thoracic segments, T1 through 12, 5 lumbar segments and 5 sacral segments. Okay. Usually the caecilial segments are not even indicated on these dermatome maps because they're not very large or important. Okay. If we put the human in a quadruped position, we can see why those dermatomes are the way they are, because in early development, of course, the limbs are very short and stubby when these things first develop. So the body is segmented the same way the spinal cord is segmented, if we look at it this way. Okay? Now why do we start the map with the C2 innervation here in the middle of the head? Why? Yeah. Everything else is cranial nerve, that's right. Okay, so the cranial nerves innervate the face, primarily the fifth cranial nerve. Okay. Now there are other cranial nerves too, but the skin, skin surface of the face there, forehead and face, is the fifth cranial nerve. Then we have the cervical segments, okay? Then the thoracic, the lumbar, and the sacral. So with this kind of map, if you look at the dermatomes, then we know that the caudal most part is right around the anus, the very tail end, okay? And the reason for these funny ways divided up in the legs and arms is because of the way those nerves grew in development, okay? But basically they follow the dermatomal pattern that you see here. Now the innervation of adjacent dorsal roots here, and here they, the cartoon here on the right, they're showing, they only show a single axon in each. They're showing a single peripheral nerve that may enter several spinal nerves, so it goes in through several different dorsal roots. That's what they're showing there. And they show that out in the periphery, it can come, there is some overlap, okay? Of the way these innervate, but it's a limited amount of overlap. Now, how do those things map? How were they mapped? Well, there was two major methods. First of all, the regions that become hypersensitive when a single spinal root is irritated. Of course, you could stimulate it electrically, but we usually don't experiment like that with human beings. But we don't have to because they have problems with backs, like intervertebral discs can slip and herniate and put pressure on a dorsal root. They can even transect a dorsal root. Usually they cause initially just irritation, and then we can map the area of the body that is shows the irritation. The irritation, of course, results in action potential, so it gives us feeling like it's coming from the skin. Like if we hit a nerve, which you can hit a nerve in your elbow because it's very close to the surface there. So that's why we call it the funny bone. We can actually disturb it and fire action potentials there. That's similar to this method of mapping a dermatome. So we can map the hypersensitive regions. We can also look at what happens in the rare cases where there's a severance of adjacent spinal nerves, that there's one nerve remaining, and sort of as an island, we'll see it in the area of remaining sensibility. So that's how these were mapped. And sometimes we talk about a myotome also, the corresponding muscles of the ventral root at the same segment, and there's a pretty good correspondence between the position of the dermatomes and myotomes. All right, and my timing was perfect today. We're right at the end of the hour.